Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, the good martini is very welcome news in a number of different ways. You lead the morning jolt with some new numbers from several different polls. Here's what you write. It was a fact of life in the Obama years when asked by pollsters, do you think the country is on the right track or headed in the wrong direction? The answers were overwhelmingly negative. The wrong direction response could get anywhere from the mid-50s to the 70s. It even hit 80% a few times in the Rasmussen polls. The right track answer was as low as the teens, usually in the 20s, sometimes just above 30%. On January 9th, the Investor's Business Daily survey found 42% saying the country is headed in the right direction. A few weeks later, the same pollster found the right track respondents at 50%. Rasmussen's last three polls had the right track respondents in the 40s. And then this morning in the morning consult poll, 41% of voters said the country headed in the right direction, compared with 29% who felt that way immediately after the presidential election. There's also other good polling news, not just for Trump, but for people who like to have secure borders. A new survey from Harvard Harris, provided exclusively to the Hill newspaper, found that 80% of voters say local authorities should have to comply with the law by reporting to federal agents the illegal immigrants they come into contact with. 52% say they support Trump's two executive orders allowing for the construction of a southern border wall, increasing the number of immigration officers by 10,000, and finding a way to revoke federal funds for sanctuary cities. In fact, 75% of voters love the crackdown on sanctuary cities, Jim. So that's good to see that people still appreciate the law and people seem more optimistic. We can certainly try to scratch our heads and figure out exactly why the numbers are improving so quickly. But despite the hysteria in the media, people see things on the rise.
You know, Greg, this is why people listen to this podcast. They get to hear me talking out loud and thinking through pieces that will probably run a National Review in the not-too-distant future, CPAC schedule permitting. So for a lot of the last couple of years, we had Americans who were, you want to use the term elites, economic elites, whatever, you know, the Acela class, however you want to characterize them, who were doing pretty darn well. And people outside of that, particularly in the Rust Belt, upper Midwest, blue-collar America that wasn't doing as well. And I'm sure these people in the blue-collar are among those who felt very strongly the country is going in the wrong direction. And they had plenty of evidence to support this theory when they looked around them: high unemployment, higher costs for health insurance, the opioid addiction crisis, increasing suicide rates, things like that. Trump gets elected. Trump gets elected largely campaigning to this group and suddenly seeing shifts in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio and even, you know, states like Minnesota. And my suspicion is, particularly you do the partisan breakdown on this right track, wrong direction number. Obviously, Republicans are feeling much better about the state of the country than they were just a few months ago. And unsurprisingly, Democrats feel much, much worse than they did about the state. Around this same time, the markets, particularly the Dow Jones, have taken off like a rocket, right? I mean, basically, if you have a 401k right now, you opened up your last statement, and even if you can't stand Trump, you're looking at that and saying, yes, you know, I might be able to retire someday after all. And my suspicion is we now have a situation which I don't know if the Rust Belt, blue collar, laid off workers who are dealing with opioid addiction, I don't know if they have 401ks. But my suspicion is that they still feel better because Trump is in office and they feel like they've got a president who listens to them. They took a president who said he was going to fight for them. And it's early enough that not much disillusionment has set in yet. Now, that may change in the coming months or the coming year. The people who are most furious about Trump, the ones who are showing up to the Women's March and the ones who are dressing up like giant women's body parts and all that kind of stuff, the Acela class is up in arms and furious about Trump. But actually, they're doing pretty darn well. The stock market is going off like a rocket. It is up 25% in the past year. Do you feel like we should have invested a bit more earlier, Greg?
Yes, that would have been nice.
So my suspicion is that everybody's got a reason to feel better, either genuine economic, like there's a boom going on, and God knows whether this boom continues or whether it's just isolated to the stock market or something. And you've also got this sense amongst Rust Belt working class America that somebody's listening to them. So everybody's got some reason to feel better. The question is, does the economic factor weigh more heavily in their minds in the months to come? Or does the political and cultural factor weigh more heavily in their minds? But either way, I'm glad people are feeling better. And I think sometimes these things are kind of a virtuous circle, that because people feel better, they spend more money, they're more likely to hire, that economic confidence can be self-sustaining.
Yeah, and if we can get some policies to help that along in the next year or so, that'd be great. Tax reform, Obamacare repeal and replacement, a lot of different ways that those feelings can turn into actual tangible numbers that we can quantify here, and that could be good for just about everybody in this country. So on to the bad martini now, Jim. And you talked about the Acela class. We're going to talk about them for the rest of the three martini lunch in both the bad and crazy martinis. And both of them deal with MSNBC. The first thing we're going to talk about here deals with Morning Joe. They had one of their colleagues on talking about the fact that despite all the negative press about Donald Trump, Trump supporters generally are happy with him so far because he's largely gone along with the agenda that he laid out in the campaign. And Joe Scarborough followed up by agreeing to that point, which led to Mika Brzezinski saying something that either is a Freudian slip or just shows how arrogant the media really are.
They go, yeah, you guys are going crazy. He's doing, what are you so surprised about? He's doing exactly what he said he's going to do.
Well, and I think that the dangerous, you know, edges here are that he's trying to undermine the media, trying to make up his own facts. And it could be that while unemployment and the economy worsens, he could have undermined the messaging so much that he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job.
That's our job to control what everybody thinks, Jim. Whatever happened to reporting the facts and letting the people make up their own minds?
So here's where we get into an Inception multi-level dream type aspect of this discussion, Greg. Because the people who read me in the Morning Jolt and contributions to The Corner and National Review Online, by and large, like the core component of my philosophy on politics and a good portion of life is get out of my face. I don't want to deal with you. Could you tell CPAC is approaching? This is, I'm going to have to be social through, you know, much of this period. But, you know, by and large, I cannot stand the nanny state. I cannot stand Mike Bloomberg telling you, no, you can't have that large soda. I cannot stand people saying that this pop culture offering is problematic, you know, that it basically is creating an unsafe space. I kind of just want everyone to stop nagging me. And I want, and, you know, not just to me, but to the citizenry at large, you know, deep down, if you believe in freedom, if you have this kind of generally conservative philosophy of life, you believe that most people can take care of themselves. Most people have enough good judgment, to be able to make their way through life and make the right choices, even eventually. Yes, a lot of people are going to make mistakes, but you know what? That's part of the human condition. There is not some government bureaucrat who knows better than them and that can save them from the consequences of their own bad judgment. That is not, you know, that's not compassion. That's actually interfering with Darwinism. Some people are going to be dumb enough to do really stupid things. They're going to end up as a YouTube video and a cautionary tale for the rest of us. So I look at that. So I think this is leaving people in freedom. Now, I asked people once on Twitter, do you think I tell people what to do? And a lot of people said, yes, you are telling people what to do because I'm telling you to leave them alone. So in a very strange way, even those of us who are, you know, maybe it's just inherent in the role of the media. When you say this statement is right, this statement is wrong, this course of action is right, this policy is right, that people perceive that as telling people what to do. So maybe some of this is baked in the cake. But deep down, Mika Brzezinski and a good portion of folks in the media look at every little aspect of our lives and decide this has to be politicized. There is a right choice and there is a wrong choice, and they are not comfortable with letting you make that decision for yourself. And that, I think, is what is a big factor in this. We discussed this earlier in the week regarding Milo. We regard this, you know, regarding political correctness and whether your employer is going to freak out about something you post on social media. You know, deep down, we have a real problem in this country of people doing things differently than us, and we just need to fix them. And if there's anything we've ever learned from the classic, I think it was a political philosophy film. Other people kind of see it as more a broader appeal or a broader message, Greg. But I think back to the Joss Whedon Serenity based on the Firefly television series. People aren't fixable. And when you fix them, you generally turn them into hideous mutant monsters. No, generally you make things worse is the general message from that. So I think I would like Mika Brzezinski to stop telling people what to think and, in fact, stop trying to fix people, at least in the political realm, and recognize that's much more traditionally a realm for areas of religion and philosophy and things like that. It is not meant to have the compulsory power of the state.
Jim, excellently said. I fear that I might be diving into heavy lifting territory here, but the I can fix it, a line that you just said, just shattered the dreams of every girl or every woman who for some reason is fixated with a bad boy.
There you go. Yes, I can fix him. Yeah, generally you can't, actually. And people would say, I don't tell you what to do. Now, here's my book on marriage and fatherhood and career advice, available to find retailers everywhere.
Well,
buy it, said insisting to tell people what to do.
All right, on to the crazy martini now, Jim. And one of the things, as you just pointed out, that the media likes to do is to look at every aspect of things and decide what the right thing is and the wrong thing is. And basically the premise behind all that is that they know better. It's not just the media. A lot of people have that frame of reference, and certainly it comes that way from liberal bureaucrats and so forth. But the media loves to tell you the way things really are because they are so much smarter than the rest of us, and they know things and they remember things and they can put everything in context. Well, maybe not. Katie Turr is a correspondent for MSNBC. I believe she followed the Trump campaign for most of the campaign, and she also apparently does some anchoring. She was speaking with Florida Congressman Francis Rooney, a Republican. Katie Turr pointing out that she's wondering if Trump can actually be firm and fair with Russia when there are so many people that have reputations for being too friendly, in her estimation, with Russia, like Mike Flynn, like Rex Tillerson, like Paul Manafort, that have been in the Trump orbit. And then here's how this went.
You say there's a lot of conservatives who are going to push back on Russia, but I see a lot of folks within Donald Trump's administration who have a friendlier view of Russia than maybe past administrations did.
Well, I think it was Obama that leaned over to Putin and said, I'll have a little more flexibility to give you what you want after the re-election.
I'm sorry, I don't know what you're referring to, Congressman.
Remember when he leaned over at a panel discussion or at a meeting and he said, I'll have more flexibility after the election. No one really ever pushed the president on what he meant by that, but I can only assume for a thug like Putin that it would embolden him.
Congressman Francis Rooney, Republican of Florida, thank you so much for joining me and happy President's Day to you, sir.
She has absolutely no idea. So, Jim, let's get in the Wayback Machine all the way back to 2012. Here is Obama, and it's actually Russian president at that time, Dmitry Medvedev, at the sidelines of one of the summits.
This is my last election, basically.
Yeah,
and after my election, I have more flexibility.
Yeah. I understand. I transmit this information to Vladimir and Medvedev.
This is my last election. After my election, I'll have more flexibility. And then Medvedev says, I will transmit this to Vladimir. So, Jim, I remember earlier in the campaign, we were making fun of young reporters who didn't remember the details of Whitewater. Jim, this was less than 5 years ago. How do you not remember this? This led to the whole thing with Romney and Obama at the debate on the foreign policy stage. For Katie Turr to be clueless on this is just stunning.
Well, I'm going to offer two or three, you know, very qualified defenses of Katie Turr on this. Obviously, the congressman is misremembering. It was Medvedev he said it to. So maybe if the congressman had said, remember when Obama said to Medvedev, I'll have more flexibility. And obviously, you know, you can't emphasize enough the sheer sinister tone of Medvedev. I will transmit this to Vladimir. Well, that should make us feel relaxed. Then maybe she might have jostled a neuron back there in the back of her mind and she might have remembered. Later on, she apparently got a lot of heat for this on Twitter and said, look, back in 2012, I was covering police shootings and fires in New York City for the local NBC affiliate. Okay. We really shouldn't be that mad at Katie Turr. We should be mad at whatever assignment editor, whoever put her in that position on MSNBC to interview the congressman and not really have that much of a grounding in the issue of U.S.-Russian relations and things like that, so that when he makes a comment like that, she can't place it. And you mentioned it. We don't know if it was Katie Turr. It probably was some other correspondent who, while covering Hillary Clinton in the 2016 campaign, one point heard some sort of reference and said out loud, what's Whitewater? Which feels like not that long ago to you and I, Greg, but, you know, apparently we're old crotchety farts. And you know, but these young hip millennials, you know, can't be bothered to crack a book every now and then. I have long believed that the biggest gap in your cultural memory is going to be between when your last American history course ends and when you're old enough to follow the news. So for someone our age, I'm going to say about the Vietnam War, Cambodia, to about the mid-Reagan years is actually a giant blank. We're talking, you know, a good portion of the 70s and early 80s. And if you look back on that, there's an enormous amount of stuff that influenced our world and the makeup of the world today. But I still read about this era and find out about things. A couple of weeks ago in the Morning Jolt, I pointed out that LaGuardia Airport got bombed in 1975 and it killed like 11 people, hundreds of people injured. They never caught the perpetrators. And this is just forgotten. The Statue of Liberty got bombed in the early 80s. Nobody remember, you know, nobody ever caught the guy. I mean, it's just an unbelievable range of things that have happened that just kind of pass out of our collective cultural memory. So I would like to see Katie Turr brush up a little bit on issues like that. On the other hand, my suspicion is this also reflects the nature of television journalism, which is you will be talking about with your guest whatever the topic of the day is, and you don't have the time to do the readings to get caught up to speed and things like that. Television journalism is very much a fight between what is visually interesting and what is actually substantively has something to contribute. I don't mean to pick on her. I think she's somebody who was forced into a difficult situation by that set of circumstances. Having said that, if you want to be a political journalist, you probably should be like a sponge trying to absorb everything that has come before so you don't get exposed like that on national television.
That's true. I think that she probably shouldn't be hammered too much for that. But her follow-up I thought was interesting. I don't know if it's MSNBC corporate policy to assume whenever a Republican says something to challenge it and suggest that it's not true. But if you don't have any idea what the guy's talking about, just move on. To basically come back with, I don't know what you're talking about, suggests that somehow he's the one who's making the mistake and is the one who doesn't have a firm grasp on history.
You know, it is that phenomenon of you're at the bar argument and so you're seeing somebody emphatically insist something that you 110% know is wrong. Now, this, I think my colleague Dan Foster once wrote an entire piece about how the fine art of BSing is rapidly dying in a world where everyone has smartphones and Google.
That's right.
Right? If it was not a live television interview by remote, the congressman could have said, oh, yeah, let me Google this. Beep, 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 beep. There's Obama and Medvedev. And then Katie Turr would go, oh, that's – yeah, okay. All right, you're right. And that would have resolved it. Kind of tough to do on live television, but maybe we should establish that, Greg. At some point, if you or I say something that the other person is utterly convinced is right, i.e. the Jets signing Jay Cutler would be an absolute disaster. You could go on Google and say, no, actually, he was pretty good. You wouldn't do that. Everybody recognizes Jay Cutler. That is an incontrovertible fact. But, you know, the idea of being able to kind of glide over topics that you kind of sort of know or might kind of remember. Look, this is what happened with Kellyanne Conway when she talked about the Bowling Green massacre, right? There was no Bowling Green massacre. There was somebody arrested in Bowling Green who was trying to give assistance to terrorists. Trump was had watched something about Sweden. And he talked about what happened in Sweden last night. Nothing had actually happened in Sweden last night. It just happened that Fox News had broadcast something about angry immigrants and Islamists in Sweden and things like that. There are a lot of things we get that kind of sort of in the neighborhood of right, but not actually right. And probably it's a good argument for why everyone should be a little humble when it comes to being absolutely emphatic. Something they absolutely are totally 100% sure is true. Without Googling and double-checking first.
You're right about the smartphone and Google era. I remember, I think it was 1998, I was having lunch with a colleague, and he had mentioned he had been to the Republican convention in San Diego in 96. And I said, oh, that's interesting. He says, hey, did you know that's where Three's Company was set? And Jim, I have a lot of holes in my pop culture resume. Three's Company is not one of them. I'm very good on Three's Company. I said, absolutely, that is incorrect. It was Santa Monica. And so we argued for about the next 10 to 15 minutes about where Three's Company had been set, even though it had been off the air for probably close to 15 years at that point. Proud to say I was right, but it's amazing how quickly things can be resolved now instead of taking up an entire lunch or even longer.
You know, I'm going to one final bit of advice. But again, I don't tell you what to do, all listeners. comes from an old Seinfeld episode. It's totally true. If you have a girl you like and you want to ask her out, but you're afraid it would be too forward, say something you know she's going to find wrong. And then when she corrects you, say, no, I'm pretty sure. I bet you dinner that, you know, 2 + 2 = 5 or something like that. And then when she corrects you, you got to take her out to dinner. That's the only way. And I believe in the Seinfeld episode, it was somebody insisting that Dustin Hoffman was in Star Wars.
That's right.
And that was it. And all of a sudden, I think it was Elaine realized, wait a minute. I just agreed to go out to dinner with him by insisting I was right. By that point, it's too late. So.
Yes. And I think whoever did that tried the same thing later in the episode by insisting that Richard M. Nixon's middle name was Moe.
There you go. Exactly. Right. So you got to make sure it's something you could be plausibly wrong about. Right. You just want to be a little bit off basis to be that. So anyway, so that's news you can use, listeners. Who knows? You never know what you're going to get when you tune into the 3 Martini Lunch.
On tomorrow's edition of 80s and 90s sitcoms, Jim and I will focus on Cheers and who knows what. Actually, Jim will be at CPAC tomorrow. Jim, I know you're gearing up for it in so many different ways, mentally and emotionally. Good luck over there.
See you on Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. David French of National Review will be in for Jim tomorrow. Join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.